Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to Reed Smith's Protecting Consumer Privacy in an Era of Rapid Change conference call. During today's presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the one followed by the four on your telephones. If at any time during the conference you do need to reach an operator, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Monday, April 2nd, 2012. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Chris Svalina, attorney with Reed Smith. Please go ahead, Mr. Svalina.
Thank you, Chantel, and thank you everyone for joining us today to hear about the FTC's long-awaited privacy report that was released early last week. Just a reminder, we have an open line here. We have friends, clients, as well as lawmakers, regulators, and press that have been invited to attend, so just keep that in mind. Before we get started, I just want to briefly introduce our speakers, who are all members of the Reed Smith Data Privacy Security Management Team. My name is Chris Svalina, and I'm in the D.C. office, where I focus on privacy compliance issues. Christine Nielsen is our newest member of our team, and she joins us from the Illinois AG's office. Paul Bond is a partner in our New Jersey office, where he focuses on privacy compliance and litigation matters. Nick Tyler, out of our London office, and like Christine, brings a regulatory perspective, having been with the EU ICO's office. And sitting here with me in the D.C. office is Amy Mushwar. Amy also works on privacy compliance matters and has a strong engineering background. Before we get into the meat of the report, just a bit of background and scope to set the stage. The final report, as most of you know, expands on a preliminary FTC staff report that was issued in December 2010, and it is consistent with the Department of Commerce's Parallel Privacy Initiative, also recently released. The FTC emphasizes, and this is important, that the report only sets forth industry best practices and is not intended to serve as a new template for enforcement. However, this line is not exactly clear, as the FTC identifies existing enforcement actions that form the basis of its advice and could be the basis of Section 5 enforcement actions throughout the report. Chairman Leibowitz recently testified specifically and expressly that the report is not a regulatory enforcement document. He said that while companies that follow the best practices would not be or ever be in violation of the FTC Act, those companies that do not follow would not necessarily be in breach of the law. That not necessarily part is something that we're going to explore a little bit today. Amy's going to talk about the legislative agenda and the political context in a minute, and Paul's going to speak more about the legal effect of this report and exactly what this report means to companies in light of the comments throughout the report and Leibowitz's recent testimony. But first, the scope. The framework applies to commercial entities that collect or use consumer data, whether online or offline, and flag that last part, it does apply offline, that can be reasonably linked to a specific consumer, computer, or device. Two carve-outs would be companies that collect non-sensitive information from less than 5,000 consumers per year and do not share information with third parties are carved out, and if the data is not reasonably linked to a consumer, computer, or device, it is carved out of the scope of this report. To meet that reasonably linked or not reasonably linked test, three things have to happen. One, the company has to take reasonable measures to ensure that the data is de-identified. They have to publicly commit to not re-identify the data. And three, they have to contractually prohibit downstream recipients from trying to re-identify the data. So in order to take advantage of that de-identification exception, those three things have to happen. Note this expansion of the definition of consumer data. It is quite different than what we are used to in the privacy context in relation to what we typically think of PII, for example, in the state breach law context. Another important note about scope, the FTC notes right at the outset that the range of privacy-related harms implicated in this framework is more expansive than physical harm or economic harm. The FTC report says that any privacy framework should recognize the harms that might arise from unanticipated uses of data and could include sharing of private information and reputational harm, regardless of whether the data at issue is considered sensitive data. So note that expansion of harm concept, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later as well today. The report calls on companies to adhere to three principles: engage in privacy by design, provide simplified choice, and exhibit greater transparency. Each of those initiatives will be described in a little more detail by Christine in a moment. Last point to mention about scope: in addition to vigorously enforcing existing laws, that's a quote, in vigorously enforcing existing laws, working with industry on self-regulation, which is another key part of this report, and educating consumers, the FTC has said that they intend to focus on five key areas. One, do not track mechanism. Two, mobile, or specifically privacy disclosures in the mobile space. Three, increased transparency of data collection practices relating to data brokers. Four, exploring privacy issues related to large platform providers. Large platform providers is somewhat of a new term. They include ISPs, operating systems, browsers, and those in social media. And five, participating in a multi-stakeholder process to promote enforceable codes of conduct. Now, Amy's going to talk about each of those five areas right now, but before you get started, Amy, can you give us some thoughts on the legislative context? Clearly, the report says throughout that they would like Congress to develop baseline privacy legislation. Could you give us a few thoughts on what's happening in D.C.?
Sure. And kind of before we go and talk about the specific parameters of any legislative proposal, let me kind of tell you a little bit of the Washington reality. 5 to 10 years ago, for technical issues, you know, FCC issues, privacy issues, these largely weren't politicized and left up to the expert agencies and engineers to develop a policy which is ultimately molded and shaped by industry. Unfortunately, now that is not the case. We more and more, and even in the privacy area, are having lines drawn by political boundaries in addition to technical boundaries. And this was best exhibited in a hearing last Thursday where Chairman John Leibowitz and NTIA Assistant Secretary Larry Strickling testified before the Energy and Commerce Committee's Subcommittee on Commerce, Manufacturing, and Trade. At that hearing, they did outline for us exactly what NTIA and the FTC would like to see in terms of a legislative proposal. They want a substantive consumer rights bill of rights in keeping with what the Department of Commerce stated 3 weeks ago, in that they want fair information practice principles along the lines of providing consumers with individual control and choice, greater transparency of privacy policy and privacy practices, respect for context of data when seeking such consent, information security, consumer access to data, which is, you know, a large complication for many environments, data accuracy, focused collection of data, meaning data minimization, and ultimately accountability, which many will have to implement through audit programs. But in addition to announcing that standard, also stating that they would support a nationwide breach standard and a couple of do-not-track proposals, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail in a moment, it's interesting to note the political context here. The Republicans in the House majority in this particular hearing voiced a very large skepticism. And the skepticism largely lied with the issue that Chris just talked about a moment ago. What is the discernible harm that we are addressing with this report? The text of the FTC report seems to address both the standard harm that we all know from our litigation context, economic and financial harm, but then also this elusive concept of embarrassment that your information has been released. And the Republicans, particularly the Chair Mary Bono Mack and the Vice Chair Marsha Blackburn, both expressed that we need a better understanding of the harm environment before we implement a widespread privacy legislation to address that harm. And we must resist the urge to rush to judgment. Mind you, Mack and Blackburn's comments also echo FTC Commissioner Thomas Roche's dissent, where he also expressed doubt for the need of regulation and legislation because of the specific harm and the less discernible harm at issue. I mean, to quote him, he said it would install Big Brother as a watchdog over these all of these practices, not only in the online, but in the offline world. So there's a clear Republican skepticism. Now, the Democrats in House majority are largely supportive of the administration's proposal. They're supportive of the fair information practices principles that were outlined by the Department of Commerce, but they have not galvanized around specific legislation as of yet. Here are my best crystal ball predictions, and they are through no inside knowledge whatsoever at this point, just my educated guess based on how long we've been watching these issues. We understand that a nationwide comprehensive framework is probably not going to get through within the next 6 months. The closest we came was the McCain bill last fall, and we just don't think we're going to get there or closer than there before the next presidential election. Where we see the larger possibility for legislation is a national breach standard, cybersecurity that's getting very, very close, closer than we've ever seen it before, and potentially do not track kids, as Representative Markey has stated that he would love to be able to pick this bill back up. And children's-related legislation always has the possibility for elevated movement. And the complications that we see to this process, of course, is the 2012 election, and then also the discernible power shift, and in that the internet sector lobbying core is much larger than it's ever been before and much more able to vocally reject very difficult and very detailed standards. And it's best exhibited by the SOPA and PIPA debate, where we really did have internet blackouts. But transitioning from the political context, the FTC in its report set discernible action items for the next year. They wanted to see and will work on a do-not-track browser standard, mobile data compliance, data broker best practices, large platform provider best practices, and they will participate in the DOC self-regulatory program. I'm going to talk just briefly about each one of these items. The first item, the do-not-track browser standard, really is a victory for self-regulation. The FTC and the Department of Commerce a couple of weeks ago support the industry efforts underway by the Digital Advertising Alliance and its online behavioral advertising and multi-site self-regulatory programs. Both agencies support memorializing these programs into a browser header standard with the standard-setting body WC3 and the Internet Browser Company. If a standard is enunciated as a browser header, that browser header would help prevent collection at the outset. Now, what's interesting is both the FTC and Commerce are generally supporting legislation in the development of a browser standard, but they are willing and they have encouraged the DAA, the WC3, and the Internet Browser Companies to steam ahead in the absence of legislation and include five principles to any do-not-track header developed. First, they want it universally implemented. The second, they want it easy to find, use, and understand. Third, it should be persistent and not overridden if a consumer clears his or her cookies. And fourth, it should be comprehensive, effective, and enforceable. And in this comprehensive, effective, and enforceable, this here is clearly where the self-regulatory program has developed a discernible win, because the Council of Better Business Bureaus helped the DAA create a very, very robust enforcement standard. And then lastly, this is what concerns industry the most, is that the opt-out for any do-not-track header standard should not be, as Chairman Leibowitz has indicated, a do-not-advertise standard, but yet a do-not-collect standard. I'll just mention this briefly, but I think for the next year we're going to be talking about web beacons versus cookies, because what can you opt out of? What information collection can you opt out of, and what information collection can you not opt out of? The clear message from the Do Not Track header standard is, for those of you who are companies and on the line right now and who are not abiding by the DAA self-regulatory program, it is in your best interest to do so immediately. Because then once the ultimate standard is developed, you'll only be implementing the browser header standard. You won't be simultaneously implementing both the DAA self-regulatory program and the browser header standard. You know, make this easy on yourselves and phase in each stage of the deployment. The next large action item that the FTC wanted to address in the next year is mobile data compliance. And this is really in keeping with the substantial mobile data compliance efforts already underway with the FTC's Children's Mobile Privacy Report that came out now about 3-4 weeks ago, the FTC updating its .com disclosures to recognize the mobile environment, and the California Attorney General settlement with the platform providers. Now, essentially, what are the trends here? The FTC would like to work with industry towards improved privacy disclosures, including the development of shorter, more meaningful privacy disclosures. So no longer can we have those very, very large restatements of our land-based or traditional web-based privacy policies. Given the recent guidance we have seen from the reports and settlements that I have named, disclosures will likely need to occur at the point of sale on the application platform. So app developers will need to work with the platform providers to do the following: to have upfront mobile-appropriate privacy policies, including items such as in-app advertising, social networking use, and in-app purchasing. They'll need to provide full contact information, and they'll need to provide upfront information regarding children's information collection to discern if COPPA is applicable. The FTC and the Department of Commerce will be starting a dialogue to discuss how members of the mobile and online ecosystems can best disclose their data collection and sharing practices to consumers, and the Commission plans to host a public workshop to this effect on May 30th of this year. In addition to mobile, data broker best practices is also an action item that the FTC would like addressed this year. The final report recommends that data broker companies provide consumers with reasonable access to the data maintained about them. The extent of such access should be proportionate to the sensitivity of the data and the nature of its use. And while the FTC in its report did not define who actually is a data broker, which is a large area of concern for those of us in the industry, if the definition of data brokers would be expanded on a large level, we could see a number of companies, you know, not just back-end skip trace providers, being subject to the data broker ultimate regulatory provisions that are developed. But what would the FTC like to see? First, they would like to see legislation. They would like to see an approved bill that includes provisions to establish a procedure for consumers to access information held by all data brokers. And then secondly, they would like to see a website. The Commission wants to see the data broker industry explore the idea of creating a centralized website where data brokers could identify themselves to consumers and describe how they collect information, consumer data, and disclose the type of companies to which they sell the information. Additionally, data brokers could use the website to explain the access rights and other choices they offer to consumers, and could offer links to their own sites where consumers could exercise such choice options. The next item that the FTC would like to see addressed this year is the issue of large platform providers. One very interesting issue in the FTC's report is that the definition of large platform providers is unlike anything we've seen before. Traditionally, when the FTC or FCC or any other agency is talking about large platform providers, they've normally restricted themselves to Internet service providers. In this case, we're looking at providers of operating systems, web browsers, social media services, and others. And what the FTC has a concern with is that these entities could potentially comprehensively track consumers and their online activities, essentially raising the same issues that we saw with the consolidated Google privacy policy. For now, it seems like the Commission is very concerned about this category, but ultimately they haven't made any decisions on exactly what they would like to do about comprehensive systematic data collection, but they have said that they will open up workshops in the third quarter of this year. And then lastly, the FTC will be participating with the Department of Commerce in a self-regulatory code program. Essentially, the Department of Commerce self-regulatory program is exactly what many of you on the line are commenting on and starting in, and those comments are due today, actually. And there are seven elements of the Department of Commerce self-regulatory program that they're seeking comments on. We know that the Department of Commerce would like to start first with mobile and develop sector-specific or perhaps technology-specific codes for each element of its program. But the FTC will be a very large and active player, and they will help other members of the industry get onto workshops and develop voluntary standards. And then just two very quick references. This wasn't in the FTC report, but it was in testimony associated with the report. Chairman Leibowitz last week mentioned on several occasions that don't expect the FTC to just be sitting and biting back and waiting for voluntary standards to be developed. Enforcement still remains a very top priority for the Commission, and where the FTC sees a clear deceptive advertising practice or a clear violation of law under the current standards, those issues will be enforced, and they will be enforced this year. And what best exemplifies that is the Rockview settlement that was just announced last week, and it clearly, there were COPA violations, there were security standard violations, you know, those type of gross violations will still be enforced this year. And then lastly, the FTC will be engaging in a substantial consumer privacy education program and is encouraging other members of the industry, as you are developing and retooling your privacy policies, for you to engage in education as well. I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Christine Nielsen out of our Chicago office, and she's going to talk about privacy by design, simplified consumer choice, and transparency.
Thanks, Amy. Many of those concepts, the privacy by design, simplified consumer choice, and transparency comments that are in the final report, are not new and don't require lengthy discussion. Some of them are very similar to what appeared in the proposed report in December 2010, and there's a lot of similarities within the final report to the Department of Commerce's report. Nevertheless, there are a few points to highlight before we turn it over to Paul to hear about what this all means. So not surprising, privacy by design has received broad support from commenters to the FTC's proposal. And so the FTC recognizes that the industry has begun to adopt privacy by design concepts. And they just reiterate that the safeguards of data security, collection limitation, retention practices, and accuracy should be implemented at every stage of the development of data products and services. So data security is obviously not a new issue, and as Amy mentioned, the FTC is in support of a national breach standard, so we may be seeing legislation on that front that the FTC would generally support. With respect to data collection limitations, companies should limit data collection to that which is consistent with the context of a particular transaction. So this idea of context is something that appears in the final report. It's very similar to what appears in the Department of Commerce report with respect to respect for context, and it's a familiar purpose specification principle as well. For data collection outside of the context of a particular transaction, the FTC recommends prominent concurrent disclosures outside of the privacy policy. So the question here to ask is this collection consistent with what a consumer might expect? If not, the company should provide prominent notice and choice. With respect to data retention, companies should implement reasonable restrictions on the retention of data, taking into account the nature of the data collected, and should dispose of the data once it has outlived its legitimate purpose. The FTC, in this respect, calls on trade associations to be more proactive in providing guidance to their members because we, again, here are focusing in on the nature of the data, the context of the data and its use, and that and those types of ideas. The FTC focuses in on teen data as an example here and actually throughout the report. So if teen data is collected, the FTC suggests shorter retention times. The FTC also suggests shorter retention times for real-time location data. With respect to data accuracy, companies should improve on consumer data accuracy in accordance with the intended use and sensitivity of the information. Companies using data to make decisions regarding consumer eligibility for credit, for example, should take robust measures to ensure data accuracy, because the intended use is something that has a very direct response to the consumer, and it's sensitive information. So the FTC recommends that these protections, these privacy by design protections, be adopted pursuant to organization-wide data privacy and security programs. And there is a mention regarding legacy systems and the idea that they understand certain programs cannot be adopted overnight, and so there will be a phase-in for legacy systems. With respect to simplified consumer choice, the FTC retains the notice and choice model and requests companies to provide a choice mechanism at a time and a context that's relevant to consumers, so generally at the point the company collects the information. So what are some practices that do not require choice? In the draft report, the FTC listed commonly accepted practices, product and service fulfillment, internal operations, fraud prevention, legal compliance, public purpose, and first-party marketing, and explained that those were practices in which a company could engage without obtaining prior consumer consent. The final report, mindful of concerns about such a static list and hearing the comments from industry groups and others who submitted comments that the list was either over-inclusive or under-inclusive, the FTC shifts the focus to the context of the transaction so that the commonly accepted practices are still maintained as illustrative examples of practices that may be considered consistent with the context of the transaction, but not necessarily. So that this shift to context means that a commonly accepted practice may indeed be the kind that does require choice if the context is inconsistent with the transaction or the consumer's relationship with the business. So one example of that is first party marketing and the practice known as retargeting in the online behavioral advertising world. If a consumer is delivered an ad based on his or her previous activity on a retailer's website, when that same consumer is tracked to a third-party website and delivers an ad while they're at the third-party website, that is the kind of practice that, although it's arguably first-party marketing, it's inconsistent with what the consumer would expect and therefore requires choice. The final report also tackles the issue of choice for data enhancement, which is the practice of appending additional data from third-party sources to data already gathered from the consumer. So even though this kind of transfer of data from business to business is likely inconsistent with the relationship the consumer has with a first-party business, the FTC stops short of recommending a choice mechanism in this context, and recognizes that it could be practically and logistically difficult to do such a thing, and just indicates that compliance with other principles in the framework will likely adequately address concerns about data enhancement. So for practices inconsistent with the context of the interaction with consumers, companies should provide choice. So the choice mechanism is at a time and in a context in which the consumer is making a decision about his or her data. And then affirmative express consent or opt-in consent is required before using data in a materially different manner than claimed when the data was collected or collecting sensitive data. So the choice timing issue is not one that's different from what we've heard of before. Just-in-time notices may be different across different industries and practices within a particular industry. The FTC notes that this principle offers some flexibility because the time a consumer is actually making a choice about his or her data differs with the type of transaction. One of the things that we did want to highlight is the FTC's comments about take-it-or-leave-it choices. The FTC highlights several of what it calls one-sided transactions, where take-it-or-leave-it choices may be inappropriate. They point to two specific scenarios, a consumer's purchase of a patented medical device and a consumer's provision of broadband services. The FTC notes that the consumer does not have adequate alternative sources to obtain the product or service in question, and that the product or service is essential. And in that context, a take-it-or-leave-it choice may be inappropriate. This is also something that Senator Franken has just recently discussed in a speech to the American Bar Association's Antitrust Division. And in his speech, he noted that when a company is able to establish a dominant market position, consumers lose meaningful choices. So this is just an area that we will continue to monitor and pay close attention to. I'm not going to discuss too much the do not track mechanism or the large platform providers because Amy has discussed those in detail. What I will turn to is the opt-in consent for material retroactive policy changes and sensitive data. So practices that require affirmative express consent include these material changes to the privacy representations and then the collection of sensitive data. Sensitive is information about children, financial and health information, social security numbers, and precise geolocation data. It's important to note there's a footnote, footnote 274, that the FTC drops in this section that describes a scenario that would not be adequate affirmative express consent. The report says, thus, for example, requiring a consumer to scroll through a 10-page disclosure and click on an I accept button would not constitute affirmative consent. Again, this is an area where we will be paying close attention. On the transparency front, the FTC recommends that the industry agree on standardized format and terminology for privacy notices and notes that the multi-stakeholder meetings being convened by the Department of Commerce may be appropriate places for this discussion about standardized format and terminology for privacy notices. With respect to consumer access to data, it should be proportional to the sensitivity and intended use of the data at issue, so we're going back again to context. There are some special considerations to be made for data brokers that Amy has already discussed. And then finally, there's special consideration that the FTC thinks should be made for teen data. The idea here is that teens may act more impulsively than others when sharing data online. So they should be allowed to erase content posted online through a special eraser button mechanism. So there has been a lot of national and international conversation about a young person's right to be forgotten, and the FTC generally supports such a right, but also notes that this eraser button feature must be carefully crafted so that it's feasible and practical and also so that it protects First Amendment rights. And as Amy mentioned, There has been legislation along these lines that has been previously introduced and may be introduced in the coming session, the Do Not Track Kids legislation. So those are some of the highlights on privacy by design, simplified consumer choice, and transparency. And I will turn it over to Paul to give us some insight into what this all means.
Great. Thank you, Christine. This is Paul Bond. With respect to what the report means, I think one of the key questions that many people reading the report have is this report a statement of current legal requirements, things I have to do now that are laid out in the report, or is it an FTC wish list on what the law of privacy should someday be? And I think it's important to step back and figure out what it is that we know for sure and what remains unsure. So we know for sure that this, what this is. This is not a new law that has been passed by Congress and gone through that process of budgetary approval and checks and balances. This also isn't a new regulation that's been promulgated and approved, even though it feels a little bit like that after several years of public conferences and workshops, the preliminary draft, and more than 450 comments from industry participants and other interested parties. What the FTC itself says is that this report establishes or suggests best practices, gives direction to Congress with respect to legislative initiatives, but they end that statement with this model of unclarity. Quote, to the extent the framework goes beyond existing legal requirements, the framework is not intended to serve as a template for law enforcement actions or regulations under laws currently enforced by the FTC, end quote. So if the report isn't a new law or regulation, and it isn't a template for enforcement actions, what exactly is it? Is it just precatory? Is it just a statement of legislative priorities for the future? Not at all. Going back to that quote, the framework is not a template for enforcement actions to the extent it goes beyond existing legal requirements. And while it's not stated in a precise way anywhere, I think that the contrapositive is true, that the report is a very good indicator of FTC enforcement priorities under its existing broad authority to enjoin unfair and deceptive practices, except to the extent that it is clear that what they're talking about is future legislation. And as has been mentioned before, this concept that there's a lot of enforceable obligations here has been ratified by comments given by Chairman Leibowitz and by other commissioners and FTC staff members, leading up to and during the release of the report and immediately after. Chairman Leibowitz saying that the report builds on our experience as an enforcement authority. There was also some interesting tweets in the Twitter dialogue that happened just after the report came out. For example, one user asking, not all entities may opt in to voluntary privacy guidelines. Without legislation from Congress, what can the FTC do? And the tweet in response was that a business that doesn't participate in self-regulation may alienate consumers. The FTC also retains existing Section 5 authority, as an authority to go after unfair or deceptive practices in commerce, which the FTC has interpreted to give itself very broad authority to decide what's unfair or deceptive. Another tweet asked, FTC, why not add some protections? You aren't here to mediate, you are here to regulate and protect. And the response to that was, the report supports baseline legislation and data security and data broker legislation. The FTC continues to enforce Section 5. Lastly, to give some sense of what a weight of enforcement authority has gone into this report, in testimony before Congress, not only did the FTC note that enforcement remains a top priority for the agency, but they spelled out all that they've done over the years. This is also in the report. 36 actions relating to data privacy and security, 80 actions for violations of the do not call requirements, 36 for FCRA violations, 97 for spam anti-spam violations, 18 actions for violations of COPPA, and on, totaling nearly $100 million in civil penalties imposed with respect to privacy actions. And that's without even tallying up what the companies had to offer to consumers in the form of restitution. And as Amy mentioned, the very next day, from having this somewhat aspirational privacy policy report, and I think the timing was no coincidence, the commission publicized a consent order with the social media company RockYou related to data security, related to standards of protecting passwords, and also standards for collecting information about minors. And there was a very a strong suggestion in the comments surrounding that report and related comments from Ed Felton, the chief technologist of the FTC, that certain things that they alleged Rock U2 have done, they considered to be kind of no-brainer violations of the requirement that every company maintain reasonable data security. So in light of this extensive history of enforcement of the FTC on data privacy and security issues, how exactly does that marry up with the best practices slash recommendations slash legislative aspirations slash potentially legal obligations in the report? It would be very nice if the report had been bifurcated into this is the law now and this is the law as we want it to be. But the report certainly isn't set up that way, leaving a lot of uncertainty. Here are a few thoughts about how to parse the report to get a good sense, if you're a company, of what it is that the FTC considers current obligations, what it is that is wholly aspirational, and what's on the fence. And I really would break it up into those three buckets. So bucket one, what is clearly within the FTC's view of an existing data privacy or security obligation? Well, start out with not violating specific laws on data privacy or security. For example, the FCRA and its regulations, or COPPA, provide certain very specific standards for collecting, using, disposing of consumer information. For those, and many of those are touched on in this report, it really isn't of there being any uncertainty or for waiting for some additional legislative or regulatory action. They're in the law and they're current legal obligations. Additionally, there are certain types of conduct that have been well established as deceptive or unfair. And by well deceptive, what I mean is where there have been multiple major enforcement actions brought by the FTC, sometimes in conjunction with other agencies, to punish companies for having done particular types of conduct. So, for example, as you go through the report, as the report lists different standards and different thou shalts, I found it useful to keep an eye on the footnotes, because many times, for example, in the security section, where it says that a company must maintain adequate security. Well, what exactly does that mean, and is it a current requirement or just something in the future? Well, if you look at the footnote and you look at the appendix with respect to milestones for FTC privacy enforcement, you'll find that, in fact, they list, between half a dozen and a dozen enforcement actions that they have specifically brought on data security issues. And those enforcement actions give a relatively clear sense of practices that they consider so obvious, so mandatory, that they've had no qualm about bringing action after action for companies for not doing them. And I think the Rock U enforcement action, where their focus was on encryption of password files, was a useful demonstration of what I put in this bucket one. I mean, they consider that to be such a no-brainer that it's not something where they're going to provide more guidance and have more industry conferences and ask Congress to pass a law necessarily, because they believe that any consumer should reasonably expect the companies that they do business with to be able to meet that standard of basic security, or in other cases, provide that level of basic choice or basic transparency. So that's bucket one. And while there are many things where it's not clear if these things fall within bucket one, where your only choice is really to comply, there are a core, a hard core of practices that that clearly do fall within bucket one. Things that relate to, for example, not saying you're going to do one thing with consumer data and then doing something materially different. Things with respect to, encryption or other protection of highly sensitive information, or use of firewalls and virus patches, other things that have become, you know, very much the standard with respect to data security and privacy. And the report, I think, where you follow the authority that is attributed to each proposition in the report, you will find many of those standards are amply demonstrated by enforcement authority. And, you know, as for those, this report clearly is not an indication that there's any need to wait. Instead, really, it is a reaffirmation that this cannot wait. So that's bucket one. Bucket two, what is wholly precatory in the report? Well, the report says that a lot of things are best practices. It also, as to some of those, has no enforcement action with respect to the issue on the books, and the report calls for legislation, scheduling of workshops, specifically calling out for industry answers or industry feedback, and for those things where the report is expressly calling out for additional authority or calling out for, you know, what the basic standard is, it would be very surprising for the FTC to then turn on a dime and say, but you, company, you violated the very standards of commercial decency by not figuring it out for yourself. And, you know, for those things that would fall into that, I think, for example, disclosures of data enhancement. You know, the FTC has never gone after any company for not disclosing that they were buying information from a third party to better understand their customers, or the specific type or implementation of privacy policies. Do they need to be machine readable or consistent with WC3 or other standards, where the report rather expressly punts and says, well, this is something that we're going to have to figure out. Well, that means they haven't really figured it out yet. Although, obviously, you know, the norms will continue to build in authority following the issuance of the report. But for right now, it's not an existing compliance obligation, except to the extent that you can point to something in bucket one and say, well, that means that I've got to do it this way. Well, if the FTC is saying, there's lots of different ways we could do it, let's figure it out, they're still figuring it out. But really the danger is bucket three, which is where the FTC takes a strong definitive position. For example, the expansion of personal data to encompass device or computer-linked data, where you don't have anybody's name, you don't have anybody's contact information, but you know, you just have information about them that you've linked to a device. And you know, that is an expansion of the traditional idea of privacy. We've usually thought about privacy as being privacy of an individual or a person, either, you know, whose name is known or it could be reasonably be found. But the FTC has taken a strong view that, in fact, personal data includes computers and devices. There's no enforcement actions on the books, but also there's no call for additional procedural clarification. They're not asking for any more conferences on it. They're not asking Congress to take action to bring computer and device identified information within the scope of personal data. The FTC has simply said, this is what it is, even though we've never brought an action to establish that, and we have no legislation or regulation to say that, and we're not asking for any. For those elements in bucket three, that really creates the greatest uncertainty, and companies have to look hard at the cost of implementing those recommendations versus the risk that, you know, they will wind up being the first enforcement action in which the principle is established. And I think there's an unfortunately large amount of the recommendations in the report fall into that third bucket, and they really have to be dealt with by each company on its own facts on a case-by-case basis. So one last note with respect to what this means, and that relates to the interoperability of the recommendations of this report with other areas of privacy law. And the answer, I think, here, the relatively simple answer is there's no safe harbor. There is no suggestion that if you're regulated by other sorts of data privacy regimes, that you can ignore those other regimes. There's also no suggestion that really you don't have to pay attention to this, to the FTC report, if you know, you are if you are otherwise regulated. The and GLBA and HIPAA, this is a common conundrum or a common circumstance for privacy practitioners. You know, each of those reports with respect to state law, for example, very expressly say, well, if state law is more protective, then you've got to do what state law does. If GLBA or HIPAA are more protective, you've got to do what GLBA or HIPAA do. And you know, essentially, you know, even though this is a federal, even though this is a federal authority, the concept is the same. I think, in fact, this will not be a problem. Well, this will not be much of a practical problem. Many of the, most of the what I call bucket one, the existing legal obligation, memorialized in the report or articulated in the report, come from, you know, privacy precedents like the OECD framework that are shared with the that are shared by the other you know, federal or state privacy laws and regulations. They come from the same basic conceptual framework. They continue to share the same space. The basics of the report with respect to locking doors, locking file cabinets, not publishing social security numbers, you know, the very basic stuff is going to be the same no matter what industry sector you're in, and even if you have another principal federal federal privacy regulator. And to the extent that there is a question of overlap, you know, to a large extent, the enforcement model may be that which was used in the Rite Aid and the CVS Caremark cases, which is joint investigation by two regulatory agencies. So, you know, I think it really is a case of needing to comply with all of the applicable standards and the, if nothing else, the recitation of standards in the FTC report is useful as an overview of where most of privacy law in this most of the privacy law in this country, a useful overview of where the privacy laws in this country are heading, even to the extent that they're not there yet. Obviously, there's a dimension of international interoperability, and I'll turn it over to Nick Tile in our London office to speak to that. Nick?
Thanks, Paul. Yes, I'm going to speak for a few minutes about the topic of improved global interoperability among the different data privacy regimes around the world and the prospects at the highest level of convergence, which is seen by many of the commenters to the FTC framework as the key to reducing companies' costs, promoting international competitiveness, and increasing compliance with privacy standards. Now, the FTC set their framework in the context of other efforts that are being made around the world to re-examine current approaches to protecting consumer privacy. Starting with the Asia-Pacific and APEC, the United States is one of the 21 APEC member economies that are currently working to implement a cross-border privacy rule system to facilitate data transfers among APEC members. The FTC highlights the consistency of their privacy framework with the 9 privacy principles of the 2004 APEC privacy framework. Then you have the OECD, who, of course, in 1980 were responsible for groundbreaking privacy guidelines, which provide the foundation for virtually all data privacy laws around the world today, currently, by the way, numbering around 90 and counting. In light of the momentous technological changes over the last 30 years and more, the OECD launched a comprehensive review of their guidelines in November last year, and that's ongoing. And then, of course, there's a lot going on over here in Europe. Just over 2 months ago, on the 25th of January, we saw the European Commission's published draft of a proposed data protection regulation, which is intended to overhaul and replace the European Data Protection Directive, which, of course, dates back to the mid-1990s. The new regulation is expected to come into force across the European Union within the next 3 years. It has quite a bit to go, though, in terms of approval on the Council of Ministers stage and obviously going through the European Parliament. And then once that's passed, there's another 2 years before it's implemented. Now, the intent behind implementation through a regulation rather than a directive is to achieve greater consistency and harmonization than has been achieved through local national laws implementing the directive. the ensuing and existing patchwork quilt of national EU data protection laws is the stuff of nightmares for multinational companies seeking to comply with all applicable laws across Europe. The draft regulation has very recently been criticized by the Article 29 Working Party, that's the influential group of the EU data protection regulators that advises the Commission, and the criticism really is based around the Commission giving itself in the regulation wide discretionary powers to adopt delegated and implementing legislation that are needed really to put some flesh on the bones of some of aspects of the regulation, but also to deliver consistency. And amid the Article 29 Working Party calls for greater discretion at national level, many will be equally concerned about whether true harmonization and consistency is indeed likely to be achieved with the deep-rooted cultural, political, and legal differences that exist across Europe. However, on a more positive note, it is now clear to see, when you look at both the FTC framework and the administration's Privacy Bill of Rights, that the thinking of lawmakers and regulators on both sides of the Atlantic, at least at the highest level, increasingly uses the same language. So, rather than dwell too much on the unavoidable complexity and difficulty of achieving compliance with global data privacy laws and regulations, let's just focus on those high-level principles of the FTC framework that are either already well-established aspects of European data protection law or, otherwise, shared principles of good practice that look likely to become a core part of future European data protection law. And I start with increased transparency and individual control. Well, these are well established in the European data protection principles that require fairness, transparency, and individual rights of access, correction, and objection. A new accountability principle and the explicit adoption of privacy by design are standout new elements of the European data protection regulation, and these owe their inclusion to the practical success of such principles as promoted under APEC legislation, and in particular through Canadian, federal, and state laws and best practice, as well as the US approach to self-regulation and compliance practice. The FTC emphasized the importance of enforcement and have been in the vanguard of attempts to strengthen cooperation in and improve the effectiveness of international investigations. But if there are any lingering doubts about the European Commission's determination to get tough with those in breach of data protection laws, a proposed new sanctions regime that could see companies fined up to 2% of global annual turnover for intentional or negligent breaches will certainly have quelled those. However, it should not go unnoted that other issues around effective enforcement, together with concerns about the European Commission's proposals for data protection notification rules, data breach notification rules, the right to be forgotten, and transfers to third countries, were raised by the FTC with the European Commission in an informal note of December 2011. On the basis of these themes, the FTC's two overarching concerns about the European draft regulation at that time were, and it must be presumed they remain, the potential adverse effect on the global interoperability of privacy frameworks resulting in divergence rather than convergence of data privacy standards globally, and serious implications for regulatory enforcement activities involving third countries, including the United States, resulting in EU data protection laws presenting a significant obstacle to international enforcement cooperation. Now, while changes were made to the draft European data protection regulation after the FTC comments were received, it's not apparent that many were changed as a result, and the absence of any major overhaul of the EU restrictions on transfers to third countries is sure to remain a particular concern going forward. And just to add to that concern, I should like to conclude with two very recent postscripts concerning developments in Asia that will likely smack of divergence rather than convergence from the US perspective. Examples of two APEC member countries introducing strict data protection regimes closer to the European than the APEC model. First of all, South Korea. Their strict data protection laws are, as of yesterday, the 1st of April, now subject to enforcement, following the end of an extended enforcement moratorium. The need for a strict regime in the Republic of Korea was prompted by a series of significant data breaches and hacking attacks in recent years, affecting millions of individuals in a country with 100% broadband coverage, where mobile devices are pervasive and electronic banking universal. And in the Philippines, a new data protection law has recently cleared the legislature and is expected to be signed into law shortly. The proposed law adheres to rigorous international principles and standards and is based on the EU Data Protection Directive, with an eye toward a potential European Commission determination that the new regime could provide adequate privacy protections to allow the easier flow of EU citizens' personal data to the Philippines. A key driver for this is the Philippines' status as a leading outsourcing host for customer call centers and a desire to expand into higher value services and sectors. So convergence or divergence, we shall have to wait and see. But I leave it to hand it over to Chris, ready to wrap up. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. I mean, I think one thing we can agree on is that the report is definitely a step in the EU direction in terms of, at least in terms of, the expansion of the concept of harm and its definition of personal data. To follow up, just to wrap this up, I wanted to spend a few minutes on the Roche dissent because I think it's important, but I want to follow up on what Paul talked about. I mean, this issue of what is law versus what is aspirational versus what kind of what practices could be deceptive or unfair is really where the rubber meets the road, and it's something that we're going to be following, and we'll be helping identify which practices we think might fall into the unfair bucket, for example, and help companies address those issues. I mean, to me, deceptive is a relatively easy concept, but a word of caution there. Note that the FTC will really hold you closely to what you say. So see Google consent decree, even as far as looking very carefully at what you say and how you say you will make changes to your privacy policy. They will look very closely at your words. So deceptive is still a key prong of FTC enforcement. But this unfair prong is trickier. And I think that's where the Roche dissent really hammers home, and I urge everyone to take a look at that. It's not long, and everyone should read it. You know, his disagreement with the report and his dissent is basically four reasons. I'm not going to hit them all because we just don't have much time left. But his first problem is this unfairness thing, and his belief that the report is rooted in its insistence that the unfair prong rather than the deceptive prong should govern information gathering practices. He says that what is unfair is in the eye of the beholder. And that it is an elastic and elusive concept. The report expressly recommending that reputational harm be considered a harm that should be addressed makes it even vaguer, I think. You know, Roche points out that this is not how the FTC has traditionally proceeded, and that the Commission has represented twice to Congress that absent deception, it will not generally enforce Section 5 against intangible harm, but that's not where it's headed. See the Frostwire consent decree. Frostwire is another consent decree that you all should take a look at because it's one recent one where the unfairness prong was relied upon for the FTC's action. So currently, what does unfair mean? Well, there is a test, and in order for a practice to be unfair, there is three prongs. The injury caused must be substantial. The injury caused must be without offsetting benefits. And it must be one that consumers cannot reasonably avoid. So that's a pretty rigorous test. My concern is that as the concept of injury expands, so does the breadth of what is unfair. And I think that's something that we all need to pay attention to as we move forward. One other note that Roche talks about is this idea of choice and his concern that opt-in is going to become the de facto method for consumer choice, because he points out that the report seems to suggest that the context of the collection, when the context of the collection is not consistent with the first-party relationship, then opt-in consent is required. And he notes that that could be in the case of retargeters, for example. Well, we all retarget. Every company on this phone does retargeting advertising. When somebody comes to your website and then they leave and they go to CNN, they will see an ad from you. That's retargeting, and he's suggesting that could turn into opt-in consent being required. I think the report says that that sort of advertising would require opt-out choice, which is also new. Currently, that's not how companies are dealing with collection of data for use of retargeting. So a lot of interesting and fluid concepts here. Please do take a look at the Roche dissent. I think it is very thoughtful. I think we're going to end there and open it up for questions. One thing before we open up for questions is we will be sending out follow-up material to everybody on the call, so be on the lookout for that. And now we'll open it up for questions, and sorry that we went a little late.
Absolutely. Sure. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephones. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. And if your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw the registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. And if you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for our first question. And we have our first question from the line of Randy. Please go ahead.
Yes, my question has to do with the abuse of practice standards in the Dodd-Frank Act, which I believe the CFPB director, Mr. Cordray, said was going to be enforced principally through enforcement actions and not through rulemaking. I wonder if you could speak to how that standard, which really depends more on consumers' ability to understand and know, might weigh into this.
And you know, Randy, I'm just going to speak about this generally because this was actually a very large topic of discussion at the Association of National Advertisers Conference, and there are a number of law firms, including ours, that are going to be trying to determine what's unfair versus what's deceptive versus what's abusive. So we can certainly follow up with you on this, but it's something that all of the law firms in town are still thinking through.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, please press the 1 followed by the 4 to register any questions. One moment, please. And we have no more questions on the telephone lines.
Well, great. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines. Have a great day, everyone.